Welcome to RHRealityCheck.org's RealityCast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
On this episode of RealityCast, I'll be talking to Megan Carpentier about Dancing with the Stars and what the Bristol Palin dust-up meant. Also, the Pope eases up ever so slightly on condemning condoms, and research suggests that there's a pill you can take to prevent HIV. Amplify used one of those computer-generated video things to highlight the way that abstinence-only programs are about trying to get kids to be as prudish and immature as the people who write the programs.
Next thing was the speaker gave me a sign that said virgin. Then she had everyone spit in a cup. She passed me the cup.
No. Please don't say it.
Then she asked me to drink the spit.
No, no, no. Why? Why would anyone do this?
She said that's what losing your virginity is like.
Like drinking a cup full of other people's spit.
Yes.
The gross-out stuff in Abstinence Only tells you way more about the people who write it than it could ever tell you about what sex is really like. The Pope decided to take time this month to remind the world why we shouldn't be taking sex advice from elderly, lifelong celibates.
And now you may have been hearing about the shift at the Vatican on condom use for some Catholics, but today it became official, a clarification, which men, which women. Here's Dan Harris.
In Chapter 11 of Light of the World, the new book based on interviews with Pope Benedict, the pontiff says condom use by people like male prostitutes is a lesser evil if it would protect their partners from getting a deadly infection like AIDS.
The whole thing was incredibly confusing because it was just a quote in an interview and not some kind of major edict. In fact, the Pope was clear about one thing, which is that using contraception is always less than ideal. But he was just saying if you're HIV positive, it's slightly less sinful to have sex with a condom than to have it without. But the ideal is, as always, not having sex. So he's still a poopy head that promotes sex negativity. To make it worse, the whole thing was very vague. The one example the Pope gave, which was translated as male prostitutes, just created more confusion. It seemed he was saying that since women can get pregnant, they have no right to safety at all, but men should have an exception.
Today, his spokesman said he had personally asked the Pope if he meant just men, and the Pope told him no, he meant women too, even if it means preventing a possible pregnancy.
This is a big deal because it's the first time the Vatican has talked about condoms in a positive way as a way to prevent AIDS.
This is good news, and we should take it, especially since he caved and admitted women have as much a right not to die of AIDS as men. But we need to be clear that the Pope is not suggesting that condoms are good. He's simply saying that in the case of HIV prevention, they're a lesser evil. But let's look at the good side of this, which is that the Pope is giving in ever so slightly to reality.
Today's change is causing an uproar, frustrating the devout, while cheering those who were outraged when the Pope said last year on a trip to Africa that condoms may actually make the AIDS epidemic worse.
For people who are out on the front lines right now, Catholic relief workers working with AIDS victims, how do you think they view this?
I think this is a lifeline to them. I think because for many years they have been arguing that this is a way to prevent death.
To be cynical about this, however, I have to point out that the church has been really trying to make inroads in terms of recruitment in Africa, in part to balance their membership losses in South and Central America. The no condom stance looks particularly vicious and bleak if you're coming from the continent hit worse by AIDS. But the good news is that this means that even the Catholic Church is capable of bending its rigid, inhumane dogma if they're faced with so much opposition that they have to. The Pope probably thought that given the choice between spreading lies about condoms and condemning them, or taking a teeny tiny stance towards reason, the teeny tiny stance would keep more people on board. In fact, as you'll see from the coverage, he's actually being treated like a big hero for agreeing that perhaps widespread death is too high a price to pay for anti-sex attitudes. But he's still not taking a strong stance of putting human life before his hostility to sex.
The second statement today leaves some serious open questions. For example, if it's okay to use a condom to prevent the transmission of a life-threatening disease, where do you draw the line when it comes to serious but non-life-threatening diseases like, say, syphilis?
Except, of course, that those are life-threatening diseases if you have poor access to medical care to treat them, which is true of many people living in heavily Catholic areas. The Vatican isn't talking about using condoms to prevent other diseases, probably because they don't want to open the door to a discussion of what they really, really, really don't want, which is for women to be liberated from the rigid gender roles the Church wants to condemn them to.
The thing the Vatican is making very clear is that this is not a first step toward revising the Church's position on contraception.
It's definitely not saying that condoms are permitted or justified or approved.
So let's be clear. If it's a disease that absolutely kills men and women, the rich and the poor alike, then it's okay to use a condom. If it's a disease that will only kill you if you're too poor to get proper medical care, you probably just have to go ahead and die rather than use a condom. And if you're a woman whose well-being and very life depends on not getting pregnant, too bad. At least we know where everyone stands in the hierarchy. I'd like to welcome Megan Carpentier to the program. Megan is an associate editor for TPM Media, a feminist, and a freelance writer. She is all these things and an expert on Dancing with the Stars, as she was a professional recapper for the last season. She's here today to talk about a subject that fascinates me, the way that the latest season became a lightning bolt for conservatives fighting the culture wars. Welcome to RealityCast, Megan.
Thank you very much.
So let's start at the beginning, which is that Bristol Palin, the eldest daughter of former Alaska governor and right-wing nut extraordinaire Sarah Palin, got on this dance contest show as one of the contestants. Is there a story of how she got on and how was her actual performance on the show?
Well, it's interesting because, in fact, this was season 11, and season 10 was one of the first times they've actually had an odd number of competitors, and the widely rumored contestant for season 10 that never appeared was Levi Johnson. And so as the story went on the show, Bristol was called up while she was working as a receptionist in Alaska and hopped in her truck, as they said many times, and drove down to L.A. for the show, which would have been shortly after she and Levi's second engagement ended. Yes, I know far too much about this. So there were wide expectations, I think, when the show initially started that she would be a terrible dancer. And in fact, I think the first show showed that she was actually a fairly good dancer, particularly for someone who hadn't had a lot of performance experience. She had really good posture. She seemed to catch on with the steps really quickly. She was much better than several of the other contestants who were professional performers. So it was in that light that she was initially continuing to move forward in the competition, which is that she was better than at least half of the competition there.
But she got further than she probably deserved to get just on merit alone, would you say?
Right. I think the way that the show's algorithm works is that there's a panel of judges who give scores, and then those scores count for half of the overall score, and then the percentage of votes that a person gets counts for the other half. And the reason that's designed that way is because what it does is allows people who are very popular, who have fan bases that will continue to watch the show, to stay on longer, even if they are themselves mediocre dancers, than someone who is a great dancer but has no fan base. So it's basically a way for the producers to maximize the number of viewers. And the way that it works is that as the show goes on and people get addicted to the show and people continue to watch the show, the best dancers rise to the top because of the voter scores or because of the judges' scores, and then people will vote for the best dancers, especially as their favorites sort of cycle off. So you saw this with Kate Gosselin last season, that by all rights, Kate Gosselin should have been the first person to go. And she lasted until about halfway through the season because of her popularity and her fan base, which tended to coincide, I think, a lot with the regular Dancing with the Stars audience. And then, you know, her being on the show got the more publicity, and eventually, as the competition became sort of weighted against her, she was booted off the show. I think what we saw this season is that Bristol actually had scores to be through the middle of the show, and then when the competition was really not weighted in her favor, she continued to be pushed forward because of the outside percentage of votes that she was getting and the fact that her scores were almost comparable to some other people in the bottom. So I think the first episode where people were really surprised that she continued was the infamous gorilla suit jive episode that was all over the air afterwards, where she and her partner began their dance in the gorilla suits, which was actually not problematic and not even the first time that her partner had put one of his celebrities in a gorilla suit. It really wasn't. But the problem was that she forgot most of the steps, and actually the dance itself was terrible. In that episode, in fact, Florence Henderson was booted out, despite the fact that Bristol had really terrible scores that week. And generally speaking, if you mess up a dance as badly as she did, you don't get to continue in the competition. And so after Florence Henderson, who was, you know, one of the bottom candidates at that point, despite her own personal popularity and the fact that she was doing really great for her age, the next episode, in fact, the next time that someone was kicked out that it seemed unfair that Bristol stayed in was Rick Fox, who was actually one of the top contenders in the competition most of the time. And that's the point at which people that were very seriously invested in the show, as I think it's probably clear that I was, began to wonder if there was something going wrong. Because it's one thing to, you know, not get kicked off one week when you deserved it, but then to see some of the top competitors start to be kicked off despite getting much better scores, that tends to be more problematic, particularly for the show's viewers. And I think it was at that point that some media outlets began to pick up on Operation Bristol, which was started by conservative talk show host Tammy Bruce to really gin up people that weren't watching the show but were fans of Sarah Palin to vote for Bristol in the competition despite not contributing to the ratings. And, of course, once that got picked up in the mainstream media, first by the Daily Beast and then by other people, the more attention that brought, the more people watched the show, the more people voted, and it all continued to kind of spiral out and become a competition where conservatives really felt like they were sticking it to liberals by voting for Bristol Palin. The interesting thing, though, is that, as you probably know, not being a particularly big fan of the show, is the audience of Dancing with the Stars is actually hugely conservative. Republican voters, non-voters, independents, it's not a liberal show by any means. And I would say that among my sort of friend and family base, the people that watched it are people that I grew up with, family members who would definitely identify themselves as independents or Republicans. Just the kinds of people that I would have conversations with, most liberals and you know, anti-Sarah Palin people weren't ever watching the show in the first place. So it was very interesting to see it kind of turn into this way of sticking it to liberals when, in fact, most of the viewers were not liberals in a very traditional sense.
So with the sticking it to liberals thing, I mean, did they really, was there any hint that they thought this would have any kind of impact beyond just sort of their false belief that this would piss liberals off?
I mean, I think it had a lot more to do with supporting Sarah Palin and supporting Bristol Palin in particular, that I think there were some, you know, negative reactions by people who don't like Sarah Palin and didn't think Bristol should be on the show kind of at the outset. And then it kind of just seemed to spiral a little bit out of control into a way to somehow support Sarah Palin and or fight back against the sort of negative attention that she had gotten, instead of really having anything to do with, you know, anything positive politically, I think.
What's interesting is I was reading your recaps, and it seems like the Operation Bristol started to sort of infect, like, the way that the show is being conducted, with Bristol Palin even giving an interview where she called the other contestants fake, which struck me as like the usual culture war nonsense about Hollywood stars. The winner of the show was Jennifer Grey, who is kind of a Gen X kind of icon and was in a very famous pro-choice movie called Dirty Dancing. Do you think that that just escalated hostilities, or did Jennifer Grey have no real impact on that?
I think what was interesting is there was a lot of gossip as the show started that Bristow was being a little bit of a diva, that she didn't like Jennifer Grey personally, that she didn't like Brandy personally, whereas the show historically has been a lot about, oh, we all get along, we're such best friends, we hate to see anybody go home, and all of those sort of standard things. And it really stood out to me when Bristol came out and called sort of her unnamed competitors fake, because it really wasn't in keeping with the spirit of the show. You know, you saw, in fact, a lot of the stars in the show, a lot of the professionals on the show stand up for Bristol and stand up for Bristol's right to be there. And you saw that, you know, with Kate Gosselin and people fighting back against the gossip about Kate Gosselin and saying no, that she was delightful to work with. And whether or not that's true, that was sort of more in keeping with the tone of the show. And so when Bristol really said that to the cameras, A, the fact that the producers left in says something, but B, it was really out of character for the show. And I think you saw in one of the last two episodes, she said that winning would be a big FU to all the people that hate her mom and hate her. That too was not in keeping with the show. It wasn't, you know, even she and Mark had gone to great efforts before that to say people are really connecting with me because I represent them, and you know, I'm doing what they would do, and I'm getting up to the same level as professional performers in a slower way, but that's because I'm just, you know, real America kind of thing. And then to sort of come out in the end and say not that she thought she should win because she'd come so far or because she's worked so hard or because she really was, you know, in moments getting up to the level of some of the other dancers, but as an FU to her mother's fan base, that it too was very out of character with the show. And it kind of reflected, I think, a lot of what you see sometimes on Palin's Twitter feed or on her Facebook page, where this very sense of feeling very embattled and wanting to win, not to win, but to prove other people wrong. And I think that that's one thing that a lot of non-Palin fans respond very negatively to, this idea that you should win because you've been criticized, or you should win so you can prove everyone wrong, rather than you should win because you deserve it.
This was a big controversy, probably the biggest that I've, in the show's history at least, that it rose to my attention. How do you think that this controversy will affect the show going forward?
I mean, the real question is whether it brings back viewers for season 12. I think that the difficulty was that a lot of regular viewers were not happy to see Bristol on the show, and they weren't necessarily happy to see the way that she acted, and particularly the way that her fans sort of pushed her forward in the competition, when most people would have said that the final three should have been Brandy, Kyle, and Jennifer, or, you know, earlier Brandy, Jennifer, and Rick Fox, just, you know, by dancing standards. I'm not sure that most of those people really watched the show, and certainly most of the liberals that watched the show at the end after it started getting attention are not regular viewers. And so the question is whether or not they really come back for season 12. And I don't know that they will, unless there's another political controversy that they can gin up. I think that having Tom DeLay on for a few episodes worked really well. Having someone very hated like Kate Gosselin played very well last season, and having someone that was the fire of so much, you know, political back and forth played very well for producers this season. So they will probably try to cast someone that can do something like that again. But I don't think in terms of the show, you know, the regular viewers were very sort of disappointed to see Bristol go to the end in many cases. And I think that many of the people who tuned in for Operation Bristol or opposed to Operation Bristol were not going to probably tune into season 12 anyway.
My guest today has been Megan Carpentier, and she deserves a rest from all this Dancing with the Stars stuff. You can read her writing all over the place, but her day job is at TPM Media, where she holds down the feminist front in the doodly news media world. Thanks for coming on to Reality Cast, Megan.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, we're all full of good to great news about HIV prevention worldwide. First, the Pope chilled ever so slightly on the idea of people wrapping it up instead of dying of AIDS. And now this.
A study published in the New England Journal of Medicine reported that healthy gay men who took an antiretroviral pill called Truvada were up to 73% less likely to become infected than those who took a placebo.
Yes, hard to believe, but it's true. The drug is far from foolproof, but the men in the trial who took it every day had a 73% reduced chance of contracting HIV. In communities that have regular access to condoms and for people whose partners are happy to use them regularly, this isn't too big a deal. Condoms still work significantly better. But for people who don't have those privileges, this is big. And for people who do use condoms but otherwise have a lot of high-risk sex, this could be a great backup method. Damn, it's weird to even use contraception language to talk about HIV prevention, which has always been more fraught. But that's where we want to be.
Also part of the new good news, the Truvada is not a new drug. It's been around a while, and it's used, as part of the treatment by a lot of people who already have the infection.
Now that is absolutely correct. Truvada is two-thirds of one of the most popular regimens for the treatment of infected individuals, usually with a triple combination of drugs. Many of the regimens that are used in the United States and in other parts of the world include Truvada as two of those three drugs.
This just makes the situation even better. Of course, the downside is those drugs are super expensive, and so taking them as prevention might not be a whole lot easier or more affordable than using condoms. And using them with condoms might not be doable for the most at-risk populations at all. And it's not like you can just go to the doctor and get the drugs as prevention yet.
Would you recommend at this point, for people who are see themselves at risk, that they go to their doctor and get a prescription?
No, I wouldn't, for the following reason, that this is still just a study in men who have sex with men. We still need to confirm this in women and in heterosexual men. But importantly, before you change recommendations or create guidelines, you've got to get various bodies together, such as the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the FDA, community physicians, community input, to take a look at whether or not this should be part of a general recommendation, which would have important implications for the use of the drug.
Dr. Anthony Fauci is the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, and he's actually more excited about this than I would be. I'm cautious. A lot of the time we hear news like this and then find out it wasn't as great as we initially thought. But he seems pretty assured that this is going to be the real deal, and that HIV infection rates can be significantly slowed with the use of this drug, especially if promoted alongside condom use. But there are problems. In the study, many people who reported taking the pill every day did not actually do so. Compliance is an important part of it working. Plus, having to take the drug for years at a time might make it even harder for people to keep up with it. Look at the pill's failure rates and you'll see how people can get lax. But my biggest issue is this one that the doctor brought up.
The other thing is, you have to counsel them very, very carefully that this is not a substitute for other prevention measures. This is additive. This is an additional tool that we have in our armamentarium for prevention. That message has to be very firmly given before you can make any kinds of recommendations. So there's still a lot of work to do.
This is a bigger deal than it might initially seem. Very few people will take a daily pill as backup. To make it worse, since condoms are also contraception along with disease prevention, there are a number of political forces that are highly interested in reducing condom use rates. Take the last segment, for example. Is there a chance that the Pope's reluctant acceptance of condom use to prevent HIV will be retracted the second there is a non-contraceptive prevention measure on the market, even if it's less effective and more expensive? I wouldn't put it past the church to exploit this. But if people end up preferring the pill to the condom, that's bad. Even if they use it perfectly, it's still less effective than the imperfect use of condoms, and way worse than the perfect use of condoms. We're already seeing some evidence in some populations that perceived access to drugs to control HIV is encouraging more reckless behavior, so I worry. But on the whole, I'm pleased with this. Any weapon we can add to the arsenal is good. And now for the wisdom of Wingnuts. This is just a big sadistic fantasy for you guys, isn't it, edition. Last week, I noted that Mike Huckabee fantasized about the First Lady, her daughters, and her mother getting a pat-down at airport security. And now you get this from Cal Thomas on Fox News.
Well, I'll be glad when Nancy Pelosi gets off the government jet. I want to see her groped at Reagan National Airport.
It's getting really disturbing how these conservative male pundits react to the fear of themselves getting searched by fantasizing out loud about women they dislike getting it instead. They're implying that abuse is only wrong if it happens to dudes or women they feel belong to them.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening and see you next week.